time to turn around. All our hopes have come to be, and the people gather around. They offer all what they can bring, and no battle with that. A hundred and a song to sing, the revolution starts now.
Good afternoon and welcome to Indie Media Live, one of the most progressive half hours on the radio, because we have no corporate sponsorship and no corporate control. I'm your host, Rebecca Ferris, and I'm here every Tuesday introducing you to people who are passionately involved in the issues and causes that directly affect you and your family. I'm very excited today. My guest is Arun Gandhi. He is one of the grandsons of Mahatma Gandhi, of Mohandas K. Gandhi, and we're going to be talking about the social justice situation in the world today. But before we do that, I want to remind you that you can always stream this or any of the other great programming at WRIR 24/7 at our web stream, WRIR.org. The show that you're going to be hearing today will be re-aired tomorrow on that web stream at 11:30 a.m. and again at 2:30 p.m. on WRIR.org. I want to tell you that you can mark your calendars for the October Vegetarian Society of Richmond's monthly potluck. It's going to be held on Saturday, October the 15th at the Friends Meeting House, 4500 Kensington Avenue, at the corner of Kensington and Commonwealth. The potluck will start at 6 and the program will begin at 7. They're going to be playing the DVD, Three Steps to Incredible Health, with Dr. Joel Fuhrman. It's the 60-minute PBS pledge program that directly addresses the crisis of obesity and chronic disease that is plaguing America. Dr. Fuhrman offers a healthy, effective, and scientifically proven plan for shedding weight quickly and reclaiming the vitality and good health that we all deserve. You are invited to bring a dish to share, preferably vegan, and if you want to find out more information, vsr.org, or you can give them a call at 344-4356. Before I jump into the show today, I want to thank all of you for your generous support of WRIR last week during our fund drive. My guest today, Arun Gandhi, is the grandson of Mohandas K. Gandhi, and he is a social and political activist and author in his own right. Arun, thank you for being here with us today on Indie Media Live.
Thank you for having me on your show. It's a great pleasure.
Last week, the world celebrated World Peace Day, and there is no figure larger in the idea of a peaceful world than your grandfather, Mohandas K. Gandhi. You are one of his grandsons, and we know that although you were born and raised in South Africa, you spent 2 years with your grandfather in India. Can you tell us about those times?
Yeah, that was the time in 1946-47, just 2 years before, or a year before he was assassinated. And we, you know, periodically would go to India to visit family and friends. So that was one of those visits. And my parents left me with grandfather and when they went out traveling and doing other things. And it was a wonderful experience because during those 2 years, he taught me some lessons. They were very simple lessons, but profound meanings behind it. One of the lessons he taught me was about learning how to deal with anger. You know, I was very angry because of the humiliation I suffered in South Africa, and I was beaten up a couple of times, and I wanted revenge and eye for an eye justice. And so he taught me that anger is like electricity. It is just as useful and just as powerful, but only if we use it intelligently. But it can be just as deadly and destructive if we abuse it. So just as we channel electrical energy and bring it into our lives and use it for the good of humanity, we must learn to channel anger in the same way so that we can use that energy for the good of humanity rather than abuse the energy and cause violence and destruction. He suggested that I should write an anger journal, but write the journal with the intention of finding a solution to the problem and then commit myself to finding a solution. Now that is very important because these days people tell me they have been writing an anger journal for a long time, but it hasn't really helped them because every time they go back and read the journal, they are reminded of the incident and they just get angry all over again. So we don't want the anger to or the journal to remind us of the incident, but we want the journal to help us find a solution to the problem. I did this for many years, and I must say it helped me considerably in learning how to deal with this anger and the problem of discrimination. And I think one of the reasons why I've dedicated my life to bringing this message to people is to make them aware that discrimination, oppression, and all of these things that we do to one another are not good, and we should try to eliminate those so that we can build better relationships between.
As a teacher, I can really appreciate your grandfather's example of electricity being very useful and being very dangerous, depending on how we use it, for teaching a young boy.
Yeah, that was why he used it with me, because I was 12 years old then, and he had to explain this in terms that I could understand.
I wonder if you could help our listeners understand what South Africa was like in the 1930s and 1940s when you were growing up as a little boy there. Everybody is aware of the system of apartheid for black South Africans, but I'm not sure that people realize that all people of color in South Africa experienced a type of apartheid as well. Could you talk to us about that for a minute, Arun?
Yeah, the discrimination in South Africa was strictly between black and white. If you were not white, you were black. It didn't matter where you came from or which race you belonged to or anything. It was simply color, skin color that mattered most. And sometimes it went to the ridiculous extent that many white people who would go and get a deep suntan were temporarily considered to be non-whites and were not allowed entry into restaurants and hotels and such places. That was a very humiliating thing because as a non-white, we could go and work in the hotels and restaurants, but we couldn't go and patronize there. We couldn't go and sit and eat there. We were not allowed entry. And yet, the servers and everybody else were non-white people. So they didn't matter as workers, but they wouldn't allow you to sit next to them. And this applied to everything. All public places were discriminated, and even toilets, public toilets were discriminated. There were separate toilets for whites and separate ones for non-whites. And so it was a very humiliating experience. It just, at every step, every day, you were reminded of the color of your skin, and you were humiliated because of the color.
Most people have gotten their idea of your grandfather from the famous movie Gandhi. I'm wondering if you can tell us how accurate a portrayal that is of your father, Ben Kingsley's portrayal of your father.
I think it's a very accurate movie as far as his personality and his philosophy is concerned. It's not very accurate historically, but then it wasn't meant to be a historic documentary. It was just about the person and his philosophy, and I think that has been projected very, very well and very accurately.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Indie Media Live on WRIR. I'm your host, Rebecca Ferris, and I'm having a conversation with Arun Gandhi, one of Mohandas K. Gandhi's grandsons, a social and political activist and author. Arun, I'm wondering if you can tell us what your grandfather was like for you as a little boy. What is something that you might share with us that most people wouldn't know about him?
Well, to me, he was always a grandfather. He was very humble, very quiet, and very loving person, and very approachable. But I could understand how great he was, because while I lived with him and wherever we went, always early in the morning I would get up and find 200 or 300 people standing silently outside the house waiting to get a glimpse of him. When we traveled, we saw hundreds and thousands of people lined up on both sides of the road to get a glimpse of him passing by. So, you know, when I saw that kind of adulation, it really made me realize that he was a very loving, very great person. And, you know, he was very well loved by everybody, but he was also very humble. You know, he didn't allow all that adulation to go to his head and become arrogant or anything, but very humble and very loving person.
And also very prescient. I'm wondering how poignant it must be for you these days as you see the ongoing struggles between Pakistan and India. Your grandfather wanted very much that the country would not be divided, that India would not be divided when it gained its independence from Britain, the cause that he worked so hard for.
Yes, it was a very painful thing for him when his own colleagues betrayed him and went and signed an agreement with the British and accepted partition as a means of independence. He was willing to wait another 10 years for independence if necessary, but he wanted the country as one. He didn't want it to be divided. But because the rest of the Indian leadership decided they had enough and they wanted independence at any cost, we are now paying the price for it. And the division of the country caused so much enmity because people who lived in an area for generations were uprooted and thrown out, and you know, on both sides. And it caused so much agony and so much anger among the people that we are still paying the price for it. 60 years later, we still can't come to a resolution of being friends.
And when I read about that, I always think about your grandfather and how wise he was.
Yes, he was extremely wise, and he had a foresight. He could see things way, you know, in the future, and he could anticipate things were going wrong, and he warned the people and he warned the leadership, but nobody listened to him.
I know that you're aware, as an American citizen, as I am, that our country is one of the few countries in the world who still participate in the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you are a family member of a murder victim. Your grandfather was assassinated in January of 1948,
mm-hmm.
and his assassin, Godsey, was then executed mm-hmm. over the protestations of some of your family members, I might say.
Right.
I'm wondering how you deal with those emotions as a member of a family member of a murder victim.
Well, we have experienced a lot of violence in our family. Not only was my grandfather assassinated, but my father spent a lot of time in South African prisons protesting against discrimination and apartheid, and he was subjected to a lot of torture and hardships in prison. Consequently, he died at a very young age. He was only 64 when he died. So, and then more recently, my nephew, my younger sister's son, was killed just before the elections in South Africa when Nelson Mandela became the president. Just before those elections, he was assassinated in his home because he lived in an area that was you know, the opposition-controlled area. And he was a member of the African National Congress. And so he was assassinated at the age of 29. Now, all of these acts of violence could have made us very bitter and very violent. But one of the things that Grandfather taught, and which is part of his philosophy of nonviolence, is to learn to forgive. Now, you don't forget anything. You don't forgive and forget. But you forgive because the burden of the violence that those people committed is not yours to carry. It is theirs to carry because they were the ones who perpetrated this. And you have to purge yourself of that burden and just devote your life to creating a situation where such mad violence will not take place. And so that's the second reason why I have devoted my life to taking this message around so that we can create that kind of a peaceful, nonviolent world.
As a young boy of 14, when your grandfather was assassinated, that must have been very, very difficult for you.
Yes, it was. I mean, at that moment, you know, I had just come back to South Africa with the family when we heard the news of his assassination. And all the 2 years of living with him and all those memories were still very fresh in my mind. And I still remember that day very vividly. And my first reaction on learning about the news was one of anger. And I expressed to my parents that if I was there, I would have strangled the person who did this. And my parents reminded me of the lessons that my grandfather taught me. And they said he wouldn't appreciate that kind of talk. He would appreciate that you look at this constructively and dedicate your life to making sure that this kind of mad violence doesn't take place. So they helped me in many ways to learn to forgive and to be able to look at things more constructively and positively and try to change this world. One of the tragedies, I think, of the modern world today, all over the nations, is that we have adopted a culture of violence, a culture of violence that is so deep-rooted in us that it has overtaken our language, our relationships, our behavior, everything about us, economics, religion, social, all of these things are determined by that culture of violence. And so we have come to believe that violence is human nature, and I don't think so. If violence was human nature, we wouldn't need the military academies and martial arts institutes to teach us how to fight and kill. The fact that we need these institutes to teach us indicates that this is a learned experience, and we can always unlearn it. What is happening today is that we are abusing our anger and generating violence in society. And so we think that that is human nature and we can't do anything about it. But we can certainly learn to use that energy of anger more positively and constructively rather than abuse it and cause all the violence in society.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Indie Media Live on WRIR. I'm Rebecca Ferris, your host, and I'm having a most enlightening conversation with Arun Gandhi. He is one of the grandsons of Mahatma Gandhi, and we are participating in the World Peace Celebration that always happens the first week of September, the last weeks of September. Arun, I'm wondering if, as we look at our government policies that you were just alluding to, we are basically living with this idea of perpetual war, the war on terror, the war all around the planet. We're entering the second decade of our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we militarize our talent and our treasure so extensively. I'm wondering what words you would give to our citizens and to the world about peace instead of perpetual war?
Well, you see, because we adopted the culture of violence, we allowed the military-industrial complex to take control. And now that complex has become so widespread and deep-rooted that if we continue to produce weapons of mass destruction, somebody has to use them to make it profitable to produce them. And so we have to either have a big and powerful army and use them, or we've got to generate conflict somewhere so that those people can buy the weapons that we make. Now, President Eisenhower warned us about this way back in the 1950s when he was the president. And he said that beware of this military-industrial complex. It's going to destroy us one day. And that day is very rapidly coming. We are so so totally gripped by this military-industrial complex and that arrogance of might, you know, the arrogance of being the only superpower in the world, and that nobody dares mess around with us. That we declare war on terrorists and we declare war on anybody who goes against us. Now, that kind of attitude just leads to more trouble. And one day we can be consumed by that kind of thing because it's like cancer. You can't save yourself from it. It's going to destroy you as much as it's going to destroy anybody else. So we have to wake up to this, and part of the whole peace movement and the work that people of peace are doing is to awaken the conscience of the people and make them realize that we are destroying our civilization by this kind of attitude of militarization and superpower arrogance. We have to be humble. We have achieved great things in science and in industry and otherwise, but we need to be humble. We can't become arrogant and consider ourselves to be several notches above the rest of the world. We are part of this world, and our living and our security and our safety depends on the security and safety of the rest of the world.
We're all connected.
We are all interconnected and interrelated.
One of your grandfather's ways of having influence in a nonviolent fashion was through the idea of civil disobedience. And as we've just come through what's known now as the Arab Spring, with all of the unrest in Europe and even a couple of weeks ago on Wall Street here in the United States, can you speak to us about the value of civil disobedience and how your grandfather used this form of protest?
Civil disobedience is very old philosophy. It was, in fact, Thoreau in this country who wrote about it in the 1840s, he also used it. But unfortunately, we haven't bothered to learn about it in depth, and so everybody thinks that civil disobedience means just going out into the streets and protesting. That is civil disobedience. That is not civil disobedience. We have to learn about this thoroughly and make it a part of our attitude and our understanding. You know, civil disobedience means that we have to purge ourselves of anger. We have to remember that we don't have enemies, that we are all equal and we are all friends, but what we are trying to do is through our suffering, we are trying to change the thinking and attitude of the government or of another nation or whatever it is. So if we have a movement that is full of anger, then, you know, we are not really practicing civil disobedience. Then we are exposing ourselves to the possibility of the opponents igniting a situation and causing a violent response and then crushing us with greater violence, which is what is happening most of the places, because the methods that they have used is really not civil disobedience. Palestine, for instance, has been using civil disobedience and nonviolence for a long time. But their nonviolence is very different. They go and pelt stones at the Israeli army, and they say, well, we are not shooting them, we are only throwing stones at them. Now, that's not nonviolence. Gandhi's nonviolence was very deep-rooted. It was where you don't use any anger, you don't use any force, you respect the opponent, you don't consider the opponent to be an enemy. You have consideration and compassion for the opponent. All of these things we have to understand and accept. And also, when he protested about something, he had a backup plan. He also had a whole thing set up so that once you destroy the existing structure, that you have something to replace it with. Now, what's happening in Egypt and the Arab Spring and all that is they are destroying the existing administration, but they don't have anything to replace it with. And so there's a vacuum created in Egypt, and, the army is going to fill that vacuum, and so we're back to square one. We get rid of one dictator and put in another dictator. So, this has to be planned. It has to be properly executed. It has to be, people have to go through a period of training to understand and practice nonviolence. It's just not like what's happening today, that people just go out into the streets and start protesting and marching and say that we are practicing civil disobedience.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Indie Media Live, and we're talking with Arun Gandhi. And in the last couple of minutes that we have, Arun, I want to remind people that you are an author. You wrote A Patch of White in 1949 about the living under apartheid in South Africa. And you have recently written a book about your grandmother, The Forgotten Woman. And Mohandas K. Gandhi's Wit and Wisdom is another one of the books that you put together. And I just wanted to close with my favorite quote from your grandfather. One can measure the greatness and the moral progress of a nation by looking at how it treats its animals. And I wonder if you could close with a comment on that quote.
Yeah, it's all part of this whole philosophy of nonviolence. And, the way we treat our animals indicates the way we treat human beings. And so we have to learn how to build better relationships. So if we have good relationships with human beings and good relationships with the animals, and we realize that we are all interconnected and interrelated, that we can't destroy one species and hope to create a safe world. We are all, what happens to the animals eventually is going to happen to us, and we can see this all the time. There's lack of respect and lack of compassion in people. So all of these things are interconnected.
Well said, and thank you so much for being with us. Arun Gandhi, I appreciate everything that you're doing so much. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on your show, and I'm very glad to share my experience.
Thank you. Be kind to each other. Be kind to yourselves and to the animals and the planet. But don't be silent, because silence is the voice of complicity. We wish you peace.